Good afternoon. My talk is titled Laboratory Simulations of Solar Prominences. So as you understand, this talk will be maybe a bit different than earlier talks we've heard this week. First of all, it's not about black holes, but about solar prominences. And also, it's not a talk about a theoretical approach or a numerical approach to an astrophysical phenomena, but it's actually an experimental approach. Before I get started, I'd like to acknowledge my thesis advisor, Professor Paul Bellin at Caltech. Here's the outline of my talk. I will start with an introduction, just remind you what a solar prominence is, why we want to simulate them in a laboratory, and why we think we can do that. Then I will describe briefly the equipment we use, some of the diagnostics, and show you some results. After that introduction, I'll go on to two more specific areas, and I'd like to mention in a bit more detail. First is how a strapping field can affect solar prominence and inhibit its eruption. And next, I'll go to the interaction between two prominences, how they can affect each other, and then I'll summarize in the end. This is a picture of the sun taken from Skylab in 1974, and this is a solar prominence. It's an arch-shaped magnetized hydrogen plasma that sits on the surface of the sun. Typical length scales are 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 8 meters. Typical magnetic fields are about millitesla, and the typical density is about 10 to the 16 per cubic meter. When a solar prominence is photographed like this in the limb of the sun, you of course see it as brighter than the background. While if you take a picture of it against the disk of the sun, it tends to be darker than the background, and often you see these characteristic S shapes. So why do we want to simulate a solar prominence and its eruption in the laboratory? Well, here are some sort of obvious advantages, but I'd still like to point them out. First of all, we can observe the prominence from any angle that we choose to, any direction we want to. We can also observe it from two or more angles simultaneously, so we can get a stereographic observation of the plasma. We can stick probes into the plasma to measure various properties, or shine laser beams through, or whatever you want. To measure properties such as magnetic fields, electric potentials, densities, and temperatures. And of course, we can turn all the little knobs that control most of these properties. We can control the magnetic fields, control the currents, so we can make a series of different discharges and learn that way. So why do we think that we can recreate a solar prominence in the lab or learn about a solar prominence in the lab? Well, it turns out that solar prominences share a lot of properties with something called a spheromak, or particularly a laboratory spheromak. And just to remind you what a spheromak is, it's a simply connected plasma. It has colloidal flux surfaces as well as toroidal flux surfaces. There are currents in the plasma, of course, they're also running in the poloidal direction, the toroidal direction, and the magnetic fields are mostly determined by those currents, the currents in the plasma itself. Now, the similarities between a spheromak and between a solar prominence and the lab spheromak is that they're both characterized by force-free states. The currents and the magnetic fields are parallel or nearly parallel. Magnetic helicity plays an important role in how both of these plasmas evolve in time, and both will, given a certain amount of magnetic helicity, relax to a state, to a minimum energy state. And it's also been observed that the end product of a solar prominence eruption is something called a magnetic cloud, and satellite measurements of these magnetic clouds have shown that they are indeed in what's called Volter-Taylor states. And in other words, they're nothing but a very huge spheromaks. So given these similarities between prominences and spheromaks, it's is it reasonable to ask, can we create a prominence in a laboratory using technology that is usually used to create laboratory sphere maps? Of course, you have to modify the boundary conditions because the topology of a sphere map and a solar prominence are not exactly the same. So this is one technique used to create sphere maps in the laboratory, and it's a technique that we have modified to make solar prominences. So what you see in the top picture A up there is a cylindrical plasma gun with an inner and an outer electrode, and there's a coil wrapped around the outer electrode that generates a magnetic field. There's some gas being injected through some gas valve into the cavity between the two electrodes. Then a capacitor bank is connected between outer and inner electrode to break down the gas and form a plasma. At that point, current will run through the electrodes, through the plasma, back through the other electrode, and that will generate its own magnetic field. This is a magnetic field in what we call the toroidal direction. Now, there's a certain pressure associated with this toroidal magnetic field that will push the plasma out of the gun, and if the pressure of that magnetic field is stronger than the tension of these poloidal magnetic field lines, then there will be some reconnection, and the plasma will leave the plasma gun and fly into a larger vacuum chamber. So we've modified this technique in the following way. We've built a plasma gun that consists, first of all, of a horseshoe magnet. There's an iron core surrounded by electromagnetic coils. We inject gas through the center of each leg of the horseshoe magnet. And when the gas goes into a vacuum chamber, which is everything above this line, so this is like the gun down here, and here's the vacuum chamber wall, and vacuum is all the way above here. When the gas goes into the vacuum chamber, we apply a high voltage between each pole of the magnet. It's been gapped so that we don't get a short circuit through the metal here. That breaks down the gas, and we get a plasma with current flowing through the plasma from one pole to the other, or from one electrode to the other. And this is what the device looks like if you look from inside the vacuum chamber. It has two D-shaped electrodes. I've just removed one here for visibility. The D-shaped electrodes extend out a bit from the gas injection point to prevent some kind of arc from the gas injection directly to the vacuum chamber wall. So the idea is that we want to get the plasma from this gas injection point, which is of course also the magnet pole, over to the other side. So that would look something like this. Here you see both the D-shaped electrodes, the gas injection points, the magnetic coils beneath that generate the toroidal magnetic field, and how we envision the plasma would go from one electrode to the other. And in a smaller scale, you see, again, the D-shaped electrodes here, the plasma gun, and you can compare it to the scale of the vacuum chamber, which is this large yellow outline, so that the plasma gun is much smaller than the vacuum chamber itself. And the idea with that is that one wall of the vacuum chamber acts as the surface of the sun, while the other walls are far enough away that they won't interfere with the experiment. There are, of course, all kinds of capacitor banks here connecting all the coils and driving currents through the plasma, and there are actually capacitor banks for the gas valve, and if you have any questions about that, you can ask me afterwards, but I'm not going to really go into any detail about that right now. Here's a list of some of the diagnostics that we use. High voltage probes to measure the voltage on the electrodes, Rogowski coils to measure the current through the plasma, magnetic pickup coils and Hall probes to measure magnetic fields, ion gauges, including fast ion gauges and capacitance manometers to measure pressure. Pressures, we have triple Langmuir probes to measure densities, temperatures, and plasma potentials. Photodiodes to measure light output, including X-ray diodes to measure soft X-ray output. We use cameras to take pictures of the plasma. And we've also been working a bit with an energetic ion detector, a laser interferometer to also to measure densities. And a current graduate student in the group is now working on laser-induced fluorescence. Before I show you some pictures, I again like to just give you some ideas of what the vacuum chamber and everything looks like so you know what you're seeing in the pictures. Here is a picture of the vacuum chamber again. It's about 2 meters long, 1.4 meters in diameter, and what I call a solar gun sits here on one of the end domes. If you look from inside the vacuum chamber, you will see the two electrodes, D-shaped electrodes. The cameras are looking through this port in this view, which would be located out here, looking in through this port in this view. So what you expect to see in a picture are the two D-shaped electrodes and maybe some other ports in the background. So here's a picture taken by the cameras. There's no plasma in this picture at all. It's just sort of a reference image for what you will see, the two D-shaped electrodes, and just other ports in the background that you're not really going to see when the plasma is there. And this is what it looks like. You can still maybe make out the outline of the D-shaped electrodes here, but and here's the actual plasma. There's, of course, some reflection in the metal. This is a picture taken just immediately after the gas has broken down and formed the plasma. And what you see then is a smooth arced current channel that goes from one electrode to the other. If you were to zoom in on this, you would actually see that it consists of several smaller strands, brighter and darker strands of plasma. You also notice that the cross section is of the plasma at this point in time, it's sort of fairly small at the foot point, but fatter at the top, it's sort of bulging out a bit. As time goes on, we ramp up the current in the plasma, and the plasma pinches down to more uniform cross-section. This is probably a result of both the classical pinch effect, but also that each foot point acts a bit as an MHD thruster. It's injecting plasma up toward the top of the prominence, and that's carrying some poloidal magnetic flux with it, and that sort of adds also to pinch down the prominence. You also see the beginning of a small kink. It's just barely starting to develop here. This is another couple of microseconds later in time, and you see that this kink has grown. And I've also chosen this particular image because the strands of the plasma happen to be unusually far apart, so you can actually see that it consists of several strands of plasma here. Now, from this view of the plasma, which I call the perpendicular view, this is sort of kink here looks just like a dip right over the neutral line, which is consistent with what solar astronomers have observed on the sun. Now, this is not really a dip, though. It's of course, the result of the plasma being helical. So if you look from a different angle, you can see we're looking at sort of a 45-degree angle. You should see the D-shaped electrodes down here. And you'll see the plasma actually helical twisting as it goes from one foot point to the other. And this picture also happens actually to be one of these red-blue glasses, stereographic images. So if you were to put on red-blue glasses, you'd see this in 3D, and you can convince yourself that it's actually helix. And if you're still not convinced, you can tell your computer to look at all the different images and make a three-dimensional model for you. But we'll return to the the perpendicular view again, and this is again a couple of microseconds later in time, and you can see the plasma winding its way from one side to the other. It of course becomes brighter at some points because there's a line of sight effect. You're simply looking through more plasma right there, and it becomes brighter. And I call this shape and capital N equals 4 helix. And what do I mean with that? I will use this model later in my talk when I talk about force balance. So I'll show it right now. What I mean with capital N equals 4 is the number of turns that the plasma writhes around its axis as you go one time around this sort of fictitious toroidal envelope. And then I'm not counting only the plasma itself, but I'm also counting its image current in the electrode plane. So the plasma itself writhes around twice and then two more times for the image current, and that's what I call capital N equals 4. There's nothing magic about N equals 4. The number of turns you get, the number of writhings you get, actually depends on the ratio between the toroidal current, that is the current that flows from one foot point to the other, to the toroidal magnetic field, which of course goes in the same direction. So this is a picture taken with a lower toroidal magnetic field, and you get many more turns as you're going from one side to the other. If you wonder why this picture is a little bit more grainy, it's because the discharge becomes a lot more noisy when you lower the toroidal magnetic field, so usually we don't do that. Okay, so that was the introduction, and I'd like to talk about two more things in more detail, and I'll start with strapping fields. A strapping field is something that some astronomers have speculated will exist on the sun. It's a much larger scale magnetic field. It's much larger than the prominence itself. It would sit over the prominence, and it would sort of act to strap it down, to prevent it from erupting. And this would be a vacuum magnetic field, so normally you won't see it. Here they've been sort of lucky in taking a picture of these things. Up here you see the strapping magnetic field, and how this picture were obtained was that there was a flare somewhere else on the sun, and material was spewed out, and some was raining down on top of the strapping field, and that's why you can see it. And whatever astronomer put this together has tried to be clever here, and it's actually a composite of two images, so you can see the prominence itself down here, and then the much larger strapping field up there. And of course, with recent images now, in the X-ray regime, we know that there are these huge scale magnetic fields all over the place on the sun, so there's not much doubt that these actually would exist. The question is what effect they would have. So we decided to study that in our experiment, and so now we've added these large coils here, which makes, it's a green field, I don't know if you can see the color or not, but makes a field that goes straddles the prominence, it goes over the prominence, and it's believed that that would hold down the prominence and prevent the eruption. Here's the result. In the column to the left, you see essentially the same images as I've showed you before. Here's an evolution of the plasma from some times here, 6 microseconds down to 10 microseconds, and you can see how it grows in time. And if you look at the next column, there's a weak strapping field applied. There's no strapping field, weak strapping field. You're slightly stronger, and you can follow it out here where we have a fairly strong strapping field, and you can see that here the plasma is actually not erupting anymore. So to explain that, I'm going to show you a force balance model and the quantity you need to know is this height here, eta, which is sort of the height of the prominence from the electrode plane up to the top of the dip. It's something that's very easily identifiable in the images, and that's why I chose to measure that distance. And that's a measurement on how much the prominence is expanding. So here we have the prominence height, eta, in centimeters versus time in microseconds. And the data points that are the stars here, the asterisks, are that's no strapping field. Triangles are an intermediate strapping field, and the squares here is a stronger strapping field. And you can see how the strapping field acts to hold down the plasma. The expansion of the prominence is actually fairly linear in time, so we can convert these data sets to velocities instead. And that's what we have here. So we have prominence expansion, the eta, the t, on this axis as a function of strapping field strength, where no strapping field is right about here. And as we increase the strapping field more and more and more, you see that we can reach a point where the plasma is not expanding anymore. It's fully strapped down. You'll also notice that the sign of the strapping field matters. And that's important because some models that have been suggested, it's the pressure in the strapping field, in the overlying strapping field, or the tension in the field lines there that is holding down the underlying prominence. But of course, that would result in that the square of the strapping field would be the important quantity, but in fact, we see that the sign matters. So the model that we made for this is the following. We're looking at the forces that act on the plasma, and particularly, we're looking at some different energies here, and we make virtual displacements to find out what forces are associated with them. There's the energy associated with the toroidal magnetic flux. There's the background magnetic field that we apply with the coils, and there's the total toroidal magnetic field that's also a product of the currents in the plasma. And you can write down the energy like that to make a virtual displacement. It's pretty straightforward. And you get sort of a tension in these field lines that acts to decrease R, to hold down the plasma, decrease the radius. There's an energy associated, of course, with the toroidal current, which you can write down. It's just 1/2 Li squared. You need to just look up in some textbook what the inductance is of a torus, make a virtual displacement, and you get that force, which is called the hoop force, and that acts to increase R to make the plasma blow out. And then finally, there's the interaction between the strapping field and the toroidal current, which is simply as the J cross B interaction. If you balance those three forces, you get the force balance equation like this, and this is very similar to what's done in the magnetic fusion community when you're trying to looking at force balance for a tokamak. What is slightly different here is that our currents are writhing around the toroidal axis, so that the toroidal current has a poloidal component to it, which is actually 4 times the toroidal current, well, as long as capital N equals 4. So you need to include that in your calculation. And then we get an expression like this. So if you plug everything in here, you'll get a value for the strapping field. It'll tell you at exactly which strapping field the prominence is just perfectly strapped down. It's not going anywhere. So if we plug in all these numbers, you don't have to read them all, but anyway, we plug in the measured values for all the distances and currents and magnetic fields. We get that the strapping field required for force balance is 82 plus minus 5 millitesla. And compare that with what we observed, that the expansion ceased for a field between 88 and 103 millitesla. That's pretty good. A couple more things I'd like to point out here, though, that you have to estimate the internal inductance of the plasma, and we sort of set that to Li equals 1/2. Now, this Li, the extreme values of that would be 0 or 1. It depends on the current distribution inside of the plasma. if you really don't believe this 1/2 value, you can set it to 0, set it to 1, and then you get an extra error plus minus 27 millitesla here, but it's still a pretty good value, pretty good compared to what we have observed. An independent way of measuring when the plasma is strapped down is to look at the peak toroidal current. And there we saw that the plasma did not increase for a strapping field of 73 millitesla, which agrees with the other value. And what am I talking about down here? That's what I'm just going to show you next. This independent measurement, we're not looking at the images at all. We're just looking at the plasma current, the peak plasma current, rather, as a function of strapping field. And you get a graph like this. And what is this? What do we see? Well, first of all, I'd like to point out that as the plasma expands, its inductance is increasing. It's proportional roughly to the radius R. A larger inductance means a smaller peak toroidal current. Why is that? Well, when the experiment starts out, you have a certain amount of energy in the capacitor bank, 1/2 CV squared. Eventually, that's all fed into the plasma and must equal the inductive energy, 1/2 Li squared. So if you have a larger inductance L, then the peak current I must be smaller because 1/2 Li squared still must equal this original amount of energy that you had in the capacitor bank. In other words, since a strapped down plasma expands less, it has lower inductance from this statement. That means it has a larger peak toroidal current from this statement. And that's what we see here. We have zero strapping field. We increase the strapping field more and more and more. And the peak toroidal current goes up more and more and more until we reach a certain point when it doesn't increase anymore. And what has happened then? Well, that is when we have fully strapped down the plasma. It doesn't go anywhere anymore. It sits where it starts. And so this increase in peak toroidal current stops. And that's an indication of when the plasma is fully strapped down and it's around 80 millitesla. So that agrees with the other measurements as well as our model. Okay. Finally, I'd like to talk about another result, which is two interacting prominences. Put on this cartoon here side by side so you know what to look for. Here we have modified the what we call a solar gun to have four electrodes, which means we can make two prominences side by side. And they will evolve in time and interact. What you see in these images is a cohelicity case. That means that both prominences have the same sign helicity. They're either both right-handed or they're both left-handed. What you see is that, well, they expand, but at a certain point in time, they sort of merge, or the top of them merges, which is what I've tried to draw in this little cartoon here. And you also see that one plasma grows much stronger than the other plasma, which is smaller, which is what I've indicated here. It might be hard to see all this from just one angle, but you can take pictures from other views, what I call parallel views and top views and so forth, and you can convince yourself that this is the case. Exactly why one prominence grows faster than the other, we don't know. But we've found out a rule for this, and that is if you look at this kind of top view, you see the four electrodes and you see the plasma here. And if you turn this image so that the current is running from the bottom of the image to the top of the image, then the prominence on the right-hand side will erupt faster if both prominences are right-handed. If they're both left-handed, then the one on the left will erupt faster. So we've taken hundreds of shots like this, and it always follows this rule. We can't really explain why, but there it is. Counter-helicity case. We have one right-handed, one left-handed prominence. They expand and they start interacting, and what you can see here is that you have one prominence in the foreground, one in the background, and then there's this extra region of light in between the two. Put on the cartoon so you know what to look for. Now, this extra region of light is located right where you expect reconnection region to occur between the two prominences. Of course, there's reconnection both in the cohelicity case as well as in the counterhelicity case, but in the counterhelicity case, the magnetic fields in the interphase region are completely anti-parallel, so you expect a much more energetic reconnection than in the cohelicity case. And so what this extra light is, we believe, is it's the actual current sheet in the reconnection region, and we're seeing the collisions between ions and neutrals or electrons and neutrals that excite neutrals and give off this light. Something else you notice in the counterhelicity case is that there's a destruction of toroidal magnetic flux. You remember I mentioned that the number of writhings in the plasma, so you go from one foot point to the other, it depends on the ratio between the toroidal current and the toroidal magnetic field. At this point in time here, the cohelicity case or a single prominence would writhe about twice, going from one foot point to the other, or what I call the n equals 4 case. Here you actually see it is writhed around several times, which means that some toroidal flux have been destroyed in the reconnection process. The plasma emits X-rays, soft X-rays, and you would of course expect the counterhelicity reconnection to emit a lot more X-rays than the cohelicity reconnection. And that's actually what we see. In this plot here, you have soft X-ray output as a function of just some charging voltage on the main capacitor bank, which translates into how much current you drive through the plasma. And you'll notice, this is a log scale, and you notice that in the counterhelicity case, you're getting more than an order of magnitude as many X-rays as you would in the cohelicity case. And that's a pretty significant result. All I'm doing is just swapping two leads on a coil, and I'm repeating the experiment, and I get this extra X-ray output. So in summary of the two interacting prominences, what we see is that the interaction between two prominences can make one prominence or both erupt sooner and faster than what a single prominence would. In the cohelicity case, it's between one prominence grows faster than the other, because some helicity is transferred from one prominence to the other, and we have this rule for which one it is that always receive the helicity. In a counterhelicity case, both prominences erupt faster because there's a destruction of toroidal magnetic flux. We've shown the X-ray emissions increase with current density, and that in the counterhelicity case, the X-ray emissions are more than an order of magnitude larger, so that that indicates that indeed there is a very strong reconnection process in a current sheet somewhere. And we see this bright region in the images, which we believe is a direct imaging of the reconnection layer. So I guess to summarize my talk here, I hope I have convinced you that solar prominences can be simulated in the laboratory, and it's possible also that other astrophysical phenomena can be simulated in the lab. I've showed you that a strapping field can inhibit the eruption of a solar prominence, and this is because of a J cross B force between the prominence and the strapping field. And I've also shown you that interaction of two prominences can lead to a faster or a sooner eruption than what you would get in a single prominence case. Thank you.
Compare with the solar plasma, you know, the armor radius, which means people
aren't
comparable.
Right. We had looked at the two-fluid induction equation, and then if you order the terms in this equation from the largest to smallest, we have picked length scales, time scales, densities, temperatures, magnetic fields, such that this order is preserved. That the biggest term in solar prominence would also be the biggest in the laboratory plasma.
Could you make something to make a disks and not? You see, to have this slope. I'm not joking. You know, this slope. You know, twist it and then see if If it reconnects, it's open the field line.
Sure, I mean, why not? One would have to sit down and think about how to do that from sort of an engineering point of view or technology point of view, but why not?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a related question. Have you ever seen a single prominence reconnect with itself?
No.
This happens in the sun hall.
You mean that it would sort of erupt and then the bottom would, it would close and make a ring?
That then escapes.
No, we haven't seen that. You mean on the chamber? Or
the vacuum chamber.
The vacuum chamber is about 1.4 meter diameter. The device itself is such that the foot-point-to-foot-point distance is 8 centimeters. Of course, the plasma grows, and eventually, after a really long time, it will fill the entire vacuum chamber. Yes, something like that.
How many hertz do you usually put in?
The writhings, you mean, from 1 foot point to the other? Usually two. We can change that by varying the ratio between the current and the magnetic field. The highest? I don't know, 12, 15, something like that. It becomes difficult to count. I mean, when it becomes really twisted up. First of all, the strapping field, of course, is a vacuum magnetic field. There's no current running in that. So I'm not quite sure what. The strapping magnetic field has of course a height profile to it. It's being generated by two coils, so which means that right where the prominence forms, there is no strapping field. But as you go up, you get a stronger and stronger strapping field. There's some peak value, and it decays again. So where the prominence forms, there's essentially no strapping field, and then as it grows outwards, it'll hit the strapping field and you get the J-cross B-force.
Yes. Talking about the pressure scale height of the road prominence versus the line current prominence, do you think that has anything to do with what you see in the experiment?
The pressure scale height?
Yeah, in the real sun, the pressure scale height is just a few hundred kilometers at the chromospheric density for the sea prominence. It's small compared to the size of the prominence itself.
You mean pressure scale as relating to gravity, the
yes.
Effect of gravity? If you look at the hoop force in a prominence, even in a solar prominence, you take a typical magnetic field and calculate what the hoop force should be. It would be about one order of magnitude larger per unit mass or unit volume than what gravity is. So I really don't think gravity is actually that important. Scale height, I don't know if I can comment on that.
What can you say from
the results? It's a good question. I haven't looked at that, so I can't tell you right now. I can't give you a number, but I suppose you could get something from looking at how much toroidal flux is being destroyed and get a rate from that. But I'm sorry, I can't give you any numbers or anything more specific.
How resistive is the plasma? Can you tell us the magnetic Reynolds number or something?
Yes. okay, I believe the Lundquist number is somewhere between 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 5.
I don't know what that is. Can you?
The Lundquist number is the ratio between the diffusive time scale and the alpha time scale.
There are no more questions. Thank you very much.